Our first speaker is what you might call a veteran conflict reporter. His stories have taken him from post-communist Eastern Europe and the tumultuous Bosnia of the early 90s to the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in multiple conflict-ridden regions, such as the Niger Delta. After graduating from the University of California at Berkeley in the early 80s, Peter Mass began his career as a journalist, working as a copy editor in Brussels for the Wall Street Journal. He has since worked as a reporter for the New York Times, and the Washington Post, and has written for the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, the New York Review of Books, and Foreign Policy, among others. His first book, Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which chronicled his experiences covering the Bosnian conflict, won him the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Nonfiction, as well as a somewhat tentative connection to actress Angelina Jolie, who reportedly read the book while researching her directorial debut in The Land of Blood and Honey. His second book, Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil, has more likely made him enemies than friends, as it steadfastly documents the downward social, political, and economic spiral that is ultimately the curse of many oil-producing nations. Peter Mass is now working on a forthcoming project on the ways in which digital technologies and new media can amplify the impact of amateur videos and photos of political struggle, for which he was awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship this year. This project, which includes an exploration of corporate and government use of surveillance technologies, will also form the basis of his talk, Perpetrators and Participants, War Photographers of the Digital Age. Please join me in welcoming Peter Mass.
Thank you very much, Theodora. And I actually don't think I ever got as much attention as when Angelina Jolie happened to mention my book. I mean, I can cover as many wars as I'd like, but Angelina Jolie is worth a lot more than any of that, I think. Well, listen, thank you very much for inviting me here. It's really an honor and quite fun to be here. So I'm very grateful for that. I want to start off my talk in Iraq. In 2005, I was sent to Iraq by the New York Times Magazine to write a cover story about human rights abuses being committed at the time by American as well as Iraqi military forces. And I went there with Gilles Perez, who is kind of one of the legendary photographers, documentary photographers of our age. And after a little bit of pushing and shoving, we were able to get permission to go as embeds to Samarra, which is a town in the Sunni Triangle, which was very much kind of at the center of combat at the time. And in this town of Samarra, there was a detention center where the Americans and the Iraqi security forces were bringing their prisoners. Now, we knew from what people had told us that there were a lot of really bad things going on in that detention center. But we were told by our minders, the military, the U.S. military, we couldn't go to the detention center. We were, however, they kind of made a mistake. And one day, one of them said, we just captured a Saudi jihadi, somebody from Saudi Arabia who had come here, come to Iraq to be a suicide bomber. Would you like to go to the detention center and interview him? And we said, yes, of course. And so they took us to this detention center, and as we were walking in, and this was a former library and kind of, you know, interesting juxtaposition of a library being turned into a detention center is itself an interesting little story. And as they took us in there, we could see one policeman who was hitting one of the prisoners. And then when we went into this room, an interrogation room, there were bloodstains down the side of a desk. And we could hear screams coming from kind of the main library area, which is where they were holding prisoners, but they wouldn't let us go in there. They wouldn't let Gilles photograph anything. This was just about me interviewing the Saudi. No photos allowed whatsoever, and we couldn't do anything about that. These were the rules. We were under their kind of, well, protection as well as kind of control. And any kind of attempt to do anything against their orders would land us into trouble, would get us kicked out almost immediately. So we went out on a lot of raids with these soldiers, the American soldiers and the Iraqis, and Gilles, being the photographer that he is, got, of course, quite amazing photographs. But it was incredibly frustrating, as you could imagine, when the photographs that you really want, which in our case would be the ones from inside the detention center where the worst things we believed were happening, are precisely the photographs that we could not get. And this reflects a problem that photographers have had in many countries at many times. You're unable to take pictures of the atrocities. In Bosnia, which I covered at the time for the Washington Post, I actually never saw someone commit an atrocity. I saw the aftermath of atrocities, and I wrote about them, and photographers photographed them. But kind of connecting the perpetrator and the victim at that moment was really nearly impossible in Iraq and has also been incredibly difficult in a lot of other countries. It's a problem of proximity. Let me go back here. It's a problem of proximity, which professional photographers often don't have to these events. And it's also a problem of technology, which perpetrators and participants usually don't have. Now, digital cameras, as Theodore was just saying, and cell phone cameras in particular, are eliminating this problem because they give the participants and the perpetrators the means to do what professional photographers had been doing for so many years before. And I think what we need to do, and this is kind of where I'm going to go with this talk, is we need to go beyond the maxim, actually, that amateurs are now producing a lot of interesting photographs. For me, it's perpetrators and participants who are becoming the war photographers of the digital age. And we're seeing an entirely new range of photography from an entirely new range of people, and it's having an entirely new range of effects on events themselves. And so I want to kind of begin my talk by asking two questions and answering them. The first one is, who was the most important war photographer in Iraq? And as Theodore said, I think I'd agree that the most important war photographer in Iraq was probably the soldier or the soldiers in Abu Ghraib who took those pictures of the prisoners being abused by their American detainers. And then if you ask a question, who is the most dangerous photographer in a war zone? I think that plausibly the answer nowadays could be a soldier with a cell phone camera. And there's a third question that I want to get into, which is, what are the rights of these new photographers? So just backing up for a second, which forms of imagery are the most important? And to answer that question, you need to define important. Now, the kinds of photos that photographers like Gilles Perez takes or Antonin Kratochvil, these are important, obviously, in their own rights for their own particular reasons. I'm not trying to set up kind of one unilateral definition of important. There are different categories of important. And the category that I'm going to focus on today is the imagery that is seen most widely and that has the greatest political impact. And before I dive into this, I just need to make the kind of banal but necessary observation that due to cell phone cameras, videos and screenshots of videos are replacing conventional photographs as the imagery we look at and depend on to see the world's troubles. And so much of my talk today is going to focus on cell phone imagery as videos or as screenshots of videos. So if you ask the question, what was the most important photograph from Iraq? Was it a photograph like this? This was taken by Chris Hondros, the late Chris Hondros, who was killed in Iraq not too long ago. And this was at a checkpoint in Tal Afar in 2005. This little girl, she's 5 years old at the time, her parents had just been killed at a checkpoint by American soldiers when they drove up in their car. Was this the most important photo? It certainly got a lot of attention. It certainly dramatizes quite a bit of what happened. Was it photos like this? And this is from Firdaus Square, which is on April 9, 2003, American Marines arrived in Baghdad, as many of you perhaps remembered and saw at the time on TV. American Marines tore down this statue of Saddam Hussein, and pictures like this, as well as this particular picture, dominated the front pages of newspapers. I think the most important photos from Iraq, and this is a long war that was fought by Americans mostly, were these photos. These are the two most infamous photos from Abu Ghraib. And these photos were taken, as we know, by American soldiers. And it's really, you can't kind of overemphasize the significance of who the photographers were. They were soldiers. They were perpetrators. The key thing to understand is that it would have been impossible, basically, for anybody other than perpetrators to take these photos. A number of journalists visited Abu Ghraib. A journalist like myself, I visited a detention center in Samarra. But whenever those visits took place, everything was cleaned up, or we were kept from the places where these atrocities were taking place, or they weren't taking place when we were there. I want to say this is a personal story in some ways, because there's a liberatory kind of feeling that I kind of have when I see photos like this, that finally the things that I've been trying myself and that photographers I've been working with have been trying for so long to actually get images of and put in front of people are finally being put in front of people. Now, we spend a lot of time, and this is one of the consequences, I think, of photography of this sort. We spend a lot of time, when I say we, I mean journalists and academics, et cetera, as well as politicians, protesting government restrictions on professional photographers and the press in general. In Iraq and Afghanistan, where I've worked as both an embedded and unilateral and journalist, unilateral mean kind of operating on my own, the restrictions on what I and my photographer take pictures of were incredibly severe. You couldn't take pictures of American corpses. If you wanted to have pictures to publish pictures of wounded American soldiers, you had to get their permission in order to publish these photos. So what that means, and you can imagine what this is like, you're supposed to get the permission of a wounded soldier in order to be able to publish the picture that you have just taken of them. In Iraq, there was one other picture that Theodora mentioned that was incredibly influential. And this was the cell phone imagery of Saddam Hussein being executed. This is just a screenshot of it. I'm not going to show the imagery of it. And this imagery, actually, though, I think it was less important in America and in Canada. In Iraq, it was vitally important because it showed Saddam Hussein, not the execution itself, but the circus kind of around the execution. People were shouting at Saddam Hussein that he was a traitor, and they were shouting the name of Muqtada al-Sadr. And it showed the kind of vengeful atmosphere that surrounded not just the execution, but the whole trial of Saddam Hussein, which lots of human rights groups had already criticized as not being a fair trial. Everybody in Iraq saw this cell phone imagery, and it was much more important than kind of any statement that came out from any Iraqi or American official or any official photographs. There were no official photographs of the actual execution surrounding this event. One final Iraqi data point. This is the, as some of you, most of you, all of you maybe recall, in 2010, WikiLeaks published what it called the collateral murder video. And this was a video it had received of a U.S. helicopter gunship in 2007 shooting at Iraqi civilians and killing a number of them. This video was incredibly influential because although the American effort, campaign, whatever you want to call it, occupation in Iraq, had already been fairly discredited by this time, this really kind of topped it off because it showed civilians being killed and not much regard for or care for who was actually being targeted in this event. This is another example of perpetrator imagery. The video is from the gunship's own camera. I want to turn to Libya now, because it had an incredible kind of role as a producer, the event itself, of war imagery by perpetrators in particular. Now, if you ask yourself, what is war photography for, you'll get a lot of different answers about that. One answer you get from war photographers is that war photography aims to create evidence of crimes. It's not the only aim of war photography, but that is one aim. The uprising in Libya provided an amazing lesson in the extent to which perpetrator photography has become a new and crucial category of visual evidence of war crimes. A major new cache of evidence is being created thanks to the perpetrators themselves. For example, not long ago, just last month, a few weeks ago, Human Rights Watch released a new report about Libya. And as you can see from the caption underneath, the report was based basically on cell phone video evidence. The rebels themselves had captured some pro-Qaddafi soldiers, and they had held them, they had taken video of them, and then later on they had killed them. And it was the actual video of the prisoners alive that was used by Human Rights Watch to connect the rebels to their death. Another example, this was during the uprising itself. Video that was not intended for publication, obviously, but that some of Gaddafi's soldiers had taken of their own torture of their prisoners, was then captured and can be used in war crimes trials against them. Captured cell phone video shows other things such as rape and torture. That's in the CNN story there. Excuse me. So it's kind of a cavalcade of evidence. And then you have the most remarkable of all. And this is the Gaddafi capture footage. Now, you know, as a journalist and I think for photographers too, this is something that you would just love to have, the capture of the tyrant, you know, being present when Mussolini was captured or whatever. These are just kind of grand historical moments that usually we don't see because a photographer isn't present. Yet what you have is you have this massive amount of video evidence taken by the soldiers who captured Gaddafi of his capture. This is a screenshot from one of those videos. Now, this raises to me the interesting question of these photographers, you know, should they be called photographers? And if they are, say the folks who do this, how should they be regarded or treated? Are they accomplices to a crime? Because this is evidence, actually, that Gaddafi was alive when he was captured. And, of course, as we all know, within a few hours, not even within a few hours, I think within an hour or two, he was dead. Excuse me. How do we regard these photographers? Should they be regarded as deeply embedded photographers? Excuse me. Or accomplices? Now, I'm not going to answer this question in the affirmative yet, that the soldiers who took videos like this should be regarded as, thank you very much, great Canadian water, should be regarded as photographers and have the rights of photographers and should be perhaps given some dispensation if war crimes trials are ever held based on evidence of this sort. But I think it's a question that we really have to start considering. Soldiers who take photos that are evidence of war crimes, are they photographers? Should they be in the way of kind of people who participate in crimes and who cooperate with authorities? Should they be accorded some sort of dispensation for providing evidence for cooperating with us? I think along these lines that, you know, Libya was a zone of, in some ways, greater press freedom than any previous conflict ever had. There were professional journalists who were killed in Libya. And that is, of course, you know, kind of the highest penalty for doing your job that can ever be considered. But on the other hand, excuse me, but on the other hand, you had this profusion of evidence that you could not imagine coming out of, let's say, Iraq, because although you had some imagery, Abu Ghraib is an example of it, that came out of Iraq, it was very limited. Out of Libya, there were really no limits because of the kind of chaos of the rebel forces as well as the chaos of Gaddafi's own forces. There was no limit on what people could photograph. And so the combatants were photographing all this amazing, amazing material. It raises an interesting question, too, of will the prosecution of war crimes be determined by the video evidence that's made available? We have all this video evidence now, let's say, of Libya. Human Rights Watch puts out its reports based on video evidence. This is all great because we're going to be able to prosecute these war crimes, but does this mean that the war crimes that are going to be prosecuted are the ones for which easy video evidence is available? Now, we all know that prosecution of war crimes, it takes a lot of resources. There's not a lot of it going on, and there's more of it going on prosecution of war crimes than before, but it's limited. We also know there's not necessarily a huge desire to prosecute war crimes on the part of countries that are involved or on the part of international authorities. So the war crimes that should be prosecuted is somewhat of a different category, perhaps, from the war crimes for which there is an ample amount of particularly video evidence available. And so I think one of the things that we need to be concerned about is whether or not we're going to have war crimes that are kind of determined by photographic evidence rather than the importance of the deed itself. I want to make the kind of argument here as well for participant photography. And I think a kind of signal case is Tunisia. Now, what was the most important photograph or visual imagery from the Arab Spring, so-called Arab Spring? Was it shot by a professional? Was it shot with a professional camera? Was it distributed by a professional agency? This is my answer here. In late 2010, a fruit seller in the Tunisian town of Sidi Bouzid, who had actually a municipal inspector who had seized his scale and some of his fruit, went to City Hall, was not able to get any form of redress, and ended up pouring paint thinner on himself and immolating himself in front of the town hall. after that happened, and there was no photography, as far as we know, or cell phone imagery taken of that event. This was Mohammed Bouazizi who set himself on fire. After that event, people in the town heard about it, and protests began outside of town hall. And the cousin of Mohammed Bouazizi, Ali Bouazizi, went to one of these protests with his cell phone camera and took video of it, posted it to his Facebook page, and then Al Jazeera picked it up after it had been posted to his Facebook page. And it was the video of the protest about Mohammed Bouazizi's self-immolation that kind of triggered the revolution in Tunisia, which triggered the other revolutions. Now, I'm not making the argument here for a photograph or a cell phone image setting off the entire Arab Spring or Facebook setting off the entire Arab Spring. But I think what's kind of important to know is that this cell phone imagery played a very, very, very important role in setting off the Tunisian Revolution. And the Tunisian Revolution, as we know, was very important in setting off subsequent revolutions. And it was not taken by a professional photographer. It was not circulated by a professional agency originally. It was taken by Ali Bouazizi with his Samsung cell phone. Another quick data point. Egypt. What was the most important photograph in Egypt during its uprising against Hosni Mubarak? I think the answer is quite simple and apparent. It's a morgue photograph of Khaled Said. Khaled Said was an anti-government activist who was arrested, detained, beaten, and killed by government security agents. And somebody, and we don't know who, might have been a member of his own family, might have been somebody at the morgue, took a picture of Khaled Said's face in the morgue. This photo began to circulate a little bit. And then one day, it was seen by Will Ghonam, who was a Google employee in Dubai. And Ghonam, like many Egyptians, was outraged by this. And he then set up a Facebook page dedicated to Khaled Said, which featured very prominently this morgue photo of Khaled Said. And the Facebook page was itself quite important in helping to get the uprising going. Again, not the only thing, not necessarily the crucial thing, but very important. And it was the power of this morgue photo of Khaled Said, which not only got Wael Ghonam going, but a heck of a lot of other Egyptians. The most incendiary photograph of the Egyptian Revolution was neither shot nor circulated by professional media or by an arbitrary amateur. One of the kind of interesting aesthetic things, and there are art history people here who are a heck of a lot more qualified to talk about this, but I think the amateur videos have kind of opened up a really interesting new question, is the news and aesthetic value cleavage that kind of is taking place. Back in the day, I think, there was often a connection between the news value of imagery of war and the aesthetic value of it, kind of the powerfully composed, the professionally composed image. It was not only news, it was also aesthetically quite perfect. Now you have somewhat of a cleavage, because these amateur videos just don't quite have that same aesthetic look. If you ask what is the most, or what is likely to be the most kind of awarded photograph from Syria, what's going on there? It's probably going to be this. It's actually a series of three photos taken by a professional American photographer, some of you may have seen it, who was with three Syrian rebels, at their checkpoint. And they were just kind of hanging out, and then a tank rolls up. That's the number two. These three rebels are kind of getting to their positions, pulling up their rocket launcher. And then in the third photo, the tank shell has just landed. You see the flash there. And these three soldiers, the fourth one in the foreground, actually survived, but the three rebels, in the background there, were killed. And there's, you know, just something, I don't need to kind of explain it, I think you can see there's something quite striking about this particular photograph. And in the commentaries about that final photograph, people have already said this is likely to win the many awards for, you know, photography in the coming year. The thing is, as aesthetically and kind of capturing the moment, powerful as this is, it's probably not the most important or even close to the most important Syrian image as far as showing what was happening in Syria in terms of human rights abuses, which is kind of the hallmark of the uprising that's going on right now. And I want to make kind of having raised this aesthetic issue, a defense, actually, of this amateur aesthetic, which I find myself kind of surprised to be making, because I've worked with professional photographers for most of my life, and I'm in awe of the photography that they produce. What are the aesthetic qualities of the photos and videos that I've been talking about? The lighting is imperfect, the framing is imperfect, the focus is imperfect, everything is imperfect. Yet I think these things are strengths for two reasons. First, I think there's a certain amount of distrust of the polish of professional photography. The aesthetic perfection of the best professional photography in some ways, and not at all times certainly, can undermine its authenticity. Although amateur photography or amateur-seeming photography, because professionals can make their photographs seem amateur, can lie, and probably lies more often in some ways than professional photography does, I think the imperfection of it connotes a certain authenticity. It is a raw, uncooked, unfiltered, and it would seem closer to the truth presentation of things. Second, I think the imperfection of amateur photography gives a truer sense of what war looks like when you are in it. I've been in many wars, and what I saw during combat was always partial, clouded, out of focus, shaky. You're running, you're hiding, you're popping your head up to see something and then popping back. You're not sure where things are coming from. The ground, the sky, it all kind of mixes together. Nothing is really in perfect focus. Nothing is perfectly formatted. That's also what you see in amateur photography. When I look at the videos from Syria or from Libya, the shakiness and all that, that reminds me of what combat looked like to myself. Now, I don't think that photography should try to replicate the experience of being in war. It should do other things as well. But if you want to know the experience of being at war, in many respects, amateur photography replicates that better than some professional photography does. Let me give you an example. So these are two very similar photos taken in Libya in 2011, the one in the upper right by the late Chris Andros, the one down below by Yuri Kozarev, both, you know, amazing professional photographers. And these are compelling photographs. If you were standing next to the photographers when these photos were happening, this is probably not what you would be seeing, because first off, the flash of the rockets as they're leaving the rocket launchers, this is, you know, we're talking even faster than milliseconds, basically. The eye cannot quite see what the super fast shutter speed of the camera can see. There's also the concussion of the explosion, debris flying around. You would be wise to have your eyes closed or to have your back turned so that you're not injured or just disturbed by any of this. So this basically is not what you would see, but it is what the camera can see. So it is war as the camera sees it, not necessarily as the human experiences it. And I'm not, when I mention this, saying, therefore, these photos aren't genuine, therefore, these photos aren't authentic, therefore, these photos aren't worth looking at. They are all of those things, authentic, worth looking at, great, and necessary. But they're not everything. I want to provide just a tiny bit of historical context to this. Perpetrator and participant photography. One thing that I think we get too caught up in is, oh, because there's all this participant and perpetrator photography, it's new. It's not. There's a heritage to it. In America, some of the most important photography of the last half century has been amateur photography. This is My Lai, the My Lai massacre, in which several hundred Vietnamese civilians were killed by American troops in 1968. The only visual evidence of it was taken by an army soldier who was an army photographer. He took these photos with his own private camera. It's actually kind of an interesting aspect to it. And he gave these photographs to the Cleveland Press a year after the massacres happened. And although Seymour Hersh had just published his account of the My Lai massacre for the first time, this visual evidence was absolutely crucial in terms of really making it clear to the American public this did happen. There were these Vietnamese civilians who were killed by American soldiers. And it was a perpetrator who took these photos. Another kind of incredibly important photo in the history of America was at Kent State. This was 1970. Anti-war protesters were shot by National Guard troops in America. Four of them were killed. And this is the most famous photo that came out of it. That's probably familiar to most, if not everyone here. And it was shot by a student named John Filo, who worked in a photo lab at the local newspaper. And he actually, at age 22, won a Pulitzer Prize for this photo. He was not a professional photographer at the time, although he became one. Kind of the most important video of perhaps the last half century in America in some respects is a Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. This was, of course, 1963, and this video was taken by Abraham Zapruder, who was a women's garment manufacturer, as President Kennedy's motorcade passed through Dealey Plaza. His film was one of the few, and certainly the very best documentation of the assassination of President Kennedy, amateur film. I want to kind of swivel just for a second to Bosnia, because I think it's easy at this moment to kind of accept this profusion of visual evidence of atrocity as almost already becoming somewhat normal. And so I want to kind of use Bosnia as a counterfactual to show just actually how extraordinarily different this visual era of war photography is from what was previous. In the 1990s, I covered the war in Bosnia. And I, like all the other journalists and all the other photographers, were trying to get evidence, and we succeeded in many cases, of the atrocities that were occurring around us. Now, one of the best photographs, probably the best photograph of the Bosnian War, and some of you here are probably really familiar with this, was taken by Ron Haviv, a great war photographer. And this was taken in the early days of the cleansing of Bosnia, and these are Serbian paramilitaries who have just executed these civilians. And now, as you can see, one of them is kicking the civilian. It's a remarkable photo for many reasons. Not just what it depicts, the perpetrators and their victims, but the strange, nonchalant way the soldier who's on the right is kind of holding a cigarette in his hand as he kicks this just executed civilian. There's something else that's remarkable about this photograph. It's one of the few that I know of that shows perpetrator and victim in Bosnia. Now, this is a conflict in Bosnia in which around 100,000 people were killed, at least probably the majority of those being civilians. And this is one of the few still photos of perpetrator and victim together. There's only, and I know this for sure, one video that has become public at least that shows an atrocity actually being committed. And it actually only emerged a couple of years ago, long after the war was ended. But this is a video that shows Serbian paramilitaries with captured Bosnian soldiers who they are executing on the side of this road here. Although it may now be hard to imagine in the days of YouTube and nonstop atrocities coming out of Syria all the time, video of them, this is the only video of atrocity that came out of Bosnia, where you have perpetrator and victim together, where you have this kind of amazing proof and evidence of what was going on. I think we're truly in a different and better world with so much more evidence of war crimes, thanks to the war criminals who take pictures and video of their work. And I think, and I want to go back to this point I made earlier, that one day we'll be forced to ask whether a degree of clemency should be offered to perpetrators who provide imagery of war crimes. And it's not just a matter of conflict photography that we're talking about. We all carry cell phones, most of us. And most of them, almost all of them, have cameras in them. And so now being a participant in a political event in America or Canada also means being a photographer of it, or potentially being a photographer of it. Look at all the footage from Occupy. For example, this is a screenshot, and this video was shot in the first days of the Occupy protests. And it actually gave the movement a lot of propulsion, because what the video showed, and this is just a screenshot of it, was a New York Police Department officer coming up to a bunch of protesters who were actually penned in, who were doing nothing, and spraying them with pepper spray. The video was shot by one of the participants in Occupy, not a professional. Another example. This is actually one of the more indelible still images that emerged from the whole Occupy movement. And this shows a police officer at the University of California at Davis, where a group of protesters had sat down in a place that the police didn't want them to sit down, pepper spraying them. Like Kent State, this photo was taken not by professional journalists. And there are a lot of journalists there, a lot of photographers there, you can see. But this is actually happened to be the right place to be. It was a student who was there, a student journalist. And it's also, as some of you may know, a famous photograph for producing a really great internet meme. I think one more thing I'd like to do is mention it's really important to note the limits of this photography, because we're all sitting here, I'm standing up here celebrating what's going on. And Theodora mentioned Iran. And the most kind of important image or video that came out of Iran was a cell phone camera capturing the last moments of Nada Sultan, who was in the streets of Tehran in 2009 during the anti-government pro-democracy demonstrations, and she was shot by presumably a government agent. And somebody, we don't know who, an Iranian everyman, shot this cell phone video of her last moments. And for all kinds of reasons that we can talk about, this particular video went absolutely viral. I mean, I think most people here probably saw it. Everybody in Iran, not everybody, but most people in Iran saw it. Had an incredible political effect, but it didn't succeed because the pro-democracy movement did not succeed yet, at least in Iran. The same people are in power. So you can have a video or you can have a still image taken by an amateur that has incredible kind of power, that has incredible circulation, but doesn't quite do what you would want it to do. And in this way, you know, the amateur photographers, the amateur war photographers, the perpetrators and the participants are no different from their professional counterparts over the last half century, who would have amazing photos of amazing power, but that would not move people or would not move governments to do what perhaps should be done. I want to make a final point about press freedom and Osama bin Laden. I think I know what the most important photo of the last year was, or last 2 years, probably the last decade, and I haven't seen it. None of us have seen it. On May 2, 2011, U.S. Navy SEALs, as we all know, were helicoptered into a compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, and killed their target, Osama bin Laden. This was, as we all know, the biggest news story of the year, if not the decade, since the attacks of the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon. Now, if a photographer had somehow sneaked into the compound during the raid and taken a photograph of the dead bin Laden, he would probably have won a Pulitzer Prize for his efforts. There was no such photographer there. The SEALs, however, these are the Navy soldiers, did take pictures of bin Laden. And we have not seen those pictures. President Obama decided not to release them. And perhaps they will leak out one day, but for now they're hidden. And for all we know, perhaps they've been deleted. And these, by the way, were the kinds of photos that dominated the news coverage the next day. Very different photos, very different discussion as a result, I think, because we had photos like this as opposed to the photo of Osama bin Laden shot dead by American forces. Who owns the Osama death pictures? Who should have the power to decide where, when, and how they are published? I don't think we've even asked that question properly. And we certainly haven't answered it. And I'm not just talking about the Osama pictures. I'm talking about any pictures that soldiers have taken that militaries hold on to, delete, do not release, unilaterally decide, will not be shared with the public. I think if soldiers who take pictures are considered photographers in some way, then we have to start thinking about what rights do they have to their pictures. Are the American or Canadian publics who pay for soldiers' training and deployment and their clothing as well as their weapons, do they have a right to see the photos that their soldiers produce? I think we need to assert that right, or at least begin having a debate about that right, more than we've had in the past. Indeed, what are the rights and restrictions that the U.S. military, the Canadian military, places on its soldiers in war zones? There are many. The thing about particularly the American restrictions on soldiers in war zones is that actually they're many and they're changing and they're not codified in any consistent way and they're not subject to debate by broader public. They are established by kind of faceless military bureaucrats and that's that. That's something that I think needs to be opened up. What sort of restrictions, what sort of responsibilities should the military place on soldiers who are taking pictures during their operations? I'm going to finish now by just going back to Iraq. I was there for a month with Gilles Perez. And when we got out of Iraq, we left from Baghdad on a military transport plane. And before we were boarding, we were asked by one of the officers who were kind of controlling access to the cargo flight if we minded flying with HR. And I asked, what is HR? And he said, human remains. And we needed to get out of the country. We wanted to get out of the country. We said, okay. And so we boarded a transport plane that had about 7 coffins with American flags on it. About a 2-hour flight to Kuwait. And when we landed in Kuwait, there was a ceremony to take the coffins off of the flight. Now, I knew, because it had been debated, discussed, there was a ban on journalists, photographers taking pictures of military coffins at the time. But I thought, let me give it a try. I had my own little digital camera, and so I took it out, and I took what I thought were a couple of surreptitious pictures. Make a very long story short, after the coffins were taken off of the plane, military policemen came up to me, demanded my camera, turned it on, deleted every photograph that I'd taken of the coffins, and handed me the photo back, the camera back. There were, however, pictures that were taken of these coffins. Not the ones in this particular plate, but other ones. They were taken by a woman named Tammy Silizio. She was a contractor who worked at the military airport in Kuwait, and she took the pictures. She was an insider. Whether you want to call her a participant or a perpetrator, it doesn't matter. She certainly wasn't a professional photographer. She was able, with her access, to take these pictures. She gave them to her hometown newspaper, the Seattle Times, which then published them, and there was a great controversy about it. Amateur photographer, absolutely key, extraordinary, necessary photographs. So, to summarize, I think we need to protect the rights of perpetrators and participants to take photos and videos and to distribute them. We need to ensure that these people, rather than the military bureaucracy, have copyright, if you will, not formally speaking perhaps, to their images. We have to ensure that they won't be punished for publishing their photographs. We have to recognize that we depend on amateur photographers for images of the most pressing events. And I think that we need to acknowledge that the amateur aesthetic offers a large dose of authenticity that enables images of violence and war to be taken more seriously than, in some cases, professional images would be. And lastly, I think we need to understand that these sorts of images are an advantage, these amateur perpetrator and participant images, are an advantage in an age of scattered attention, when iconicity is not the result necessarily of formal skill and good luck, but of the sort of immediacy and access that comes from being part of an event or even part of a problem. Thank you very much. So I think, although I've gone a couple minutes over, that...
Yeah, we can have some questions.
Okay, surely.
Hi, my name is Theo, and I'm from England, UK, and I was in England during the whole Libyan war, and I was watching the BBC, and every single time you would have footages of photos from the conflict taken by participants or perpetrators, and always the journalists had to make clear to the audience that even though those were actual footages, you didn't know whether they were really reliable. And is that my question now is, those pictures taken by non-professionals, how reliable can they be? And how can we really rely on them to explain or display something?
No, I think like anything else in our society, you know, whether it's a government statement, whether it's a piece of advertising, whether it's, you know, a paper put up by an academic or an article you read in the newspaper, you have to question, you know, what is the source? What is the reliability? And when it comes from somebody you don't know, whose name you don't even know, you have to question it even more. But I think also that particularly, because we're talking now about imagery that circulates on the web, you know, the web also has, in addition to a large amount of, you know, rapid, uncritical thinking, also a lot of very quick fact-checking in a sense. And so an image can spread very quickly and people can say, oh, wow. But if it is actually an inaccurate image, there is a pretty good chance that somebody along the line is going to identify it as inaccurate. Now, kind of, you know, the exposure of an inaccurate image may not counteract entirely the initial impact that its uncritical circulation had, but it can certainly help and serve as a corrective. Professional images also have the same problem. I mean, you know, there's a lot of professional images, which, not a lot, I should say, but there are professional images which are doctored, which, you know, have been exposed as having been doctored. So, you know, we have to kind of apply skepticism and doubt to pretty much most of what we see, and we have to apply probably more of it to things that we see that we don't even know the name of the author of. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking. That doesn't mean these things might not particularly actually be authentic and showing something that is true in the sense of what it is portrayed as presenting.
Yeah, so it's just in continuation, actually, mm-hmm. to that remark. First of all, I thank you for the talk. It was really very good in the sense that it's really setting up a lot of the issues I think we'll be mm-hmm. discussing today. But that question of authenticity sort of clicked also. Mm-hmm. And I'm an art historian, so mm-hmm. this thing about aesthetics also was really interesting. Because in a way, what's interesting in your talk is that what we're seeing is that even when you're with digital photography, there is still this sort of presumption, and now even more so when you have the aesthetics of the imperfect, right, mm-hmm. that it's authentic, that there is something about, it's not indexical anymore, it's mm-hmm. not about analog photography, but it still carries a sort of expectation, right, that it's going to be, that's what we're seeing is what happened. Mm-hmm. And so that's one comment, and I think maybe that's going to come out. Mm-hmm. But I'm really surprised to see how much, in fact, that the expectation of authenticity is tied to photography, even mm-hmm. in its digital mutation. Mm-hmm. The second point, which is attached to that, is that it seems to me, however, that there is also a certain price to pay, if I can use that term, in a sense that, and I don't even know if it still carries that weight of authenticity, precisely because what's happening now is that these images are so easy to take. Mm-hmm. Anyone can take it at any time, right? They multiply, they circulate. And what is happening is that there's a sort of form of trivialization mm-hmm. of the image. So the horror that they contain starts to be banal. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, is a big, you know, I think that's a big problem of these digital, I mean, new ways of, mm-hmm. and then the authenticity sort of becomes less important because then, okay, it's more authentic, quote unquote, mm-hmm. but it's not even moving me anymore because I see them all the time. Mm-hmm. And they all look alike in a certain mm-hmm. way, dead bodies, mm-hmm. imperfect frame. Mm-hmm. And in a way, mm-hmm. so that how this, the circulation, the multiplication of these mm-hmm. photos sort of jeopardize, you know, that authenticity. Mm-hmm.
But that's, I mean, that's something that is not new to the digital era. That's something that's been going on for practically as long as photography has existed. Kind of every generation has a moment, it seems, as a result of technology or something of that sort, where things like, we are now totally inundated, it's a new era. And, you know, Sontag wrote about it initially in the 70s or whatever. And, you know, she was actually, before she died in the early 2000s, she had an essay in the Times Magazine about, you know, now we have really reached the limit. This is before YouTube came along. Okay. So I think those questions are spot on. But the amazing thing about, you know, photography and imagery is that, you know, you're an art historian. You know, going back in the era, I'm sure that, you know, is that there is no limit in the sense of, like, how we can be really kind of grabbed by a photograph. Yes, we're inundated. But every so often, somehow, for some reasons, imagery comes along that does grab us despite the absolute flood. I mean, we're flooded now. But are we not going to be struck by some photograph, by some cell phone imagery that comes along this coming year or next year or 2 years from now? We probably will be. Somehow, we still retain the image while we're kind of inured to the flood, nonetheless, of being absolutely struck and floored by some of the things that we see. You know, what the qualities are that actually grab us, I don't know. But I think I don't think we're in danger of becoming totally kind of oblivious to the imagery that we're seeing and unable to be moved by it. Because I think there's always evidence that comes along that actually we can still be moved by imagery for whatever reasons.
It's not because it becomes more horrific.
I don't think so, because the most horrific things aren't the ones that actually do it. I mean, not a sultan, okay? That image that I showed you, okay? That... You know, there are many more horrific moments in that cell phone video than the one that I showed. You know, the Saddam hanging, the shot that I took of it there, many more horrific moments there. And it's not the horrific moments that seem to grab people the most. It's actually the non-horrific ones, maybe because, you know, we're able to assimilate it better. It doesn't challenge us as much of who we are and what we think and what we want to think as the actually horrific ones do. So I think in a way that the key photography that most moves us is not the most horrific. You know, 9/11, what was the most, well, there were many kind of amazing photographs. But, you know, in America, one of the most amazing photographs from 9/11 was the so-called falling man photo. And it showed a man who was falling down from the Twin Towers. And there were a lot of incredibly graphic, incredibly horrific images and imagery that came from 9/11. The falling man photo, as horrific as it was, wasn't close to some of the other photos in terms of, you know, death, flesh, destruction. It was, I don't want to say metaphoric, but we know the level we're operating at here. That wasn't horrific. And that's one of the reasons, compared to some of the other photos, that it grabbed us. So I don't think the horrific imagery is really what drives us in some ways.
I've had ongoing dialogues for a long time with many about the possible misuse of information.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me that most academics that I know, and I used to be one, seem to presume that their job is simply to come up with knowledge and not to worry about the use or misuse of that knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That's somebody else's responsibility. Now, it seems to me that in your talk, inherent in it was the idea that documentary photographs have value in that they're documenting some aspect of reality. But then you really spent most of your time pointing out the multiplicity of uses of those photographs, which could be for reasons totally different than what the original intention of the mm-hmm. person taking the photograph. So what do we do with the question, particularly when you're dealing with war photographs, it seems to me that it tends to be the political that takes precedent almost over anything else.
Mm-hmm.
How does one somehow mitigate the question of extreme uses or of the stuff?
It's a great question. I think photographers would be better to answer this in the sense when you're talking about intentionality, you know, photographers can perhaps are better placed to kind of answer this question in the sense of what did they intend this photo to mean and how was it actually used and how do they feel betrayed. But that's precisely the point. They don't. And they never do. I mean, once they hand over their film to their editor who has the power to decide what's going to go out, what's going to be published, or, you know, somebody to put something up on Facebook, they lose the power to control it. You know, I think it was Eddie Adams' photo of the execution in Saigon. And during the Tet Offensive, the one in which the South Vietnamese police officer is shooting a captured Viet Cong. I mean, he quite famously said that, you know, the way that it was used, kind of the anti-war ways that it was used, and also the demonization of the South Vietnamese officer who was executing the Viet Cong, was absolutely contrary to what he intended. He didn't think that that South Vietnamese officer who was executing the Viet Cong was quite the kind of devil that the picture in its interpretation in the media and subsequently in history, made him out to be. And I think with a lot of photographers, and we have some here who can definitely address this question much better, understand that once you put it out there, you do lose control over what its interpretation is going to be, what is going to be used as. As a writer, I face the same problem too. I write things. I wrote a story about the invasion, about Marines killing civilians in 2003 as they were invading Iraq. And I totally lost control over what the interpretations would be, and they were multiple. There were Marines who liked it, who said to me that was right, that was good, and there were people who said that it was, you know, anti-military and unfair to the Marines. And I just have to kind of stand back and, you know, realize that particularly with the many voices, the many ways that people can express their voices now, that I'm going to only be able to do just a small amount to actually control the uses of the material I produce, and I think that's probably the way it is with photographers and photography as well.
Yes. you described certain images made by perpetrators as being necessary, in particular the images of the human remains of American soldiers. Mm-hmm. And you also described the most important image of the last 10 years being one that doesn't exist, one that we haven't seen, which mm-hmm. is the image of Osama bin Laden being killed. Now, beyond things like Abu Ghraib images providing evidence of misconduct, mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you what is to be gained from seeing the moment of bin Laden's execution? What is to be gained from having access to that real image beyond its evidence value?
That's a fantastic question. I think the evidence value is extraordinary. I mean, we all know, if we're just taking the Osama bin Laden thing, we all know that he was killed. So it's not evidence that he was killed because we doubt that he was killed. I don't think there are many people on the planet who doubt that he was actually killed. But, you know, what does killing mean? You know, what does violence look like? What does violence mean? And I think it's very easy for those who actually haven't seen it to kind of ignore kind of what it means, but also kind of as well to be taken and pushed on a particular contemplative path. You know, when you see, for example, the visuals that did dominate the debate after Osama bin Laden was executed, and they were, in America at least, they were these celebratory photos. We had a particular kind of debate that was influenced by what we saw the next day as the reaction of people. I think it would have been a somewhat different debate, somewhat different discussion, somewhat different contemplation, if instead of the celebratory photos, we had the actual photos of the violence. And I'm not saying that, you know, definitely those photos would have had that effect, but I think they can have that kind of effect in terms of affecting discussion, as well as war crimes, prosecution, et cetera. And then as well, you know, as a writer, as a journalist, I really am kind of, you know, very anti-censorship. I don't know what the effect of that photo or other photos will necessarily be. I don't know. Maybe the publication of the Osama bin Laden photograph would be negative in some political way from American security interests or Canadian or whatever. I don't know. But I don't think I should be deciding. I don't think President Obama should be deciding on his own, at least. So I just kind of, I can't answer the question of what effect, would it necessarily be a better effect? But I just think that we won't know unless we open it up. And publication has always served kind of democracy better, I think, than censorship has.
Thanks, Peter. Please join me again.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
We'll now be hearing from Sharon Slawinski.